Well, good morning. Welcome to Perspectives on WFSU-FM. I'm Tom Flanagan. Thanks so much for tuning in. And we also invite your participation via phone and email, too, if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. 414-1234 local, 800-926-8809 long distance. And that email, as always, is perspectives@wfsu.org. Hey, when you hear the words bodily organ, probably you're like me, and you think of the heart, liver, kidneys, those kinds of things. Stuff that's inside our bodies, right? But our largest organ and the one that safeguards all the others is the organ that everyone can see, and that is our skin. Well, since May is National Skin Cancer Awareness Month, it seems a good time to find out how to better protect our big external organ from threats like too much sun and other things that can hurt it. Who better to provide that information than our panel of skin experts this morning on Perspectives? So we welcome Dr. Alfredo Paredes, board-certified plastic surgeon, to Perspectives. Good to have you, Doc.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Right next door to him, Dr. Mark Inglés, board-certified dermatologist. Likewise, sir. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
And next door there, we have Dr. Jessica Yoon, who is a board-certified dermatologist as well. Dr. Jessica, good to have you.
Thank you.
All right. Let's start with this. We said just board certified, and that kind of has me a little bit, what does that mean? Dr. Alfredo, what really is board certification? Is that a good thing as far as patients are concerned? Should they be looking for that kind of stuff?
Yes, I think it's a very good thing. This is a method of standardizing a doctor's training. So that you know that when you see a certain physician who's board certified in a certain specialty, you're seeing the expert in that specialty. And so the way a patient would investigate this is the American Board of Medical Specialties has a set certification system for each of the subspecialties. So radiology, dermatology, plastic surgery, general surgery, these all have their own boards. And so when a doctor says he's board certified in cardiology, they do heart disease. And when a dermatologist is board certified in skin, that's what they do. So it's extremely important that a patient sees the right person who's trained to do the things they say they're going to do.
Okay, now can you check in and find out if someone is board certified or is there any controls on that? Anyone can just sort of stamp that
absolutely.
On?
Every specialty has its internet site that a patient can today with Google can easily look up, is my doctor board certified? There are even websites that have that exact information. And simply typing in a doctor and looking up their board certification is quite easy. The Florida's website for our Department of Health also carries much of that information, and they can actually look up their physician on that site.
Okay. Dr. Glass, let me throw this by you here. Since May is National Skin Cancer Awareness Month, mm-hmm. We're very aware of that since Florida's a sunshine state. How bad is it? How many cases of skin cancer, like, do you guys handle?
We see hundreds, if not thousands, in our practice every year. Living in Florida, the Sunshine State, and especially being at the latitude we're at, we see lots and lots of skin cancers. The average incidence of skin cancer in the United States is high. It's in the hundreds of thousands. In fact, skin cancer is the number one cancer of all the cancers in the U.S., outnumbering everything else. And a certain proportion of those are the deadliest type, melanoma. And so we see a lot of skin cancers, even down into people's early 20s and late teens.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you don't normally think of cancer as an aging type disease, 40s, 50s, 60s and
right.
up. But this and Dr. Hune, is it usually the sun that causes this, or are there other factors that can promote the growth of a skin cancer?
Well, certainly there are a lot of factors that can promote skin cancer growth, but the UV is one of the largest factors, especially in a place like Florida where people are spending a lot of their time in the sun, probably at least 9 months out of the year. And it's also one of the more controllable factors. People can wear hats. They can wear sun protective clothing. They can understand when it's safe for them to go out in the sun. And websites like weather.com can tell you exactly what the UV index is at any given time. And you can go out in the morning and see that it's a UV index of 2 or 3, and you're pretty safe. And you can follow that. And by 11 o'clock in July, you're talking about 10 plus extreme UV index. And at that time, that's when you can really control your UV. You can go inside. You can get in the shade. You can wear your sun protective clothing. And things like sunscreen are important, too, as long as you remember it's a screen and it's not a substitute for really sun avoidance and other things like that. So absolutely there are other factors, but UV is really one of the primary things that we can control.
And apparently there are different kinds of UV, Dr. Alfredo. I saw something on TV the other day. You've got the A and the B UV, and one is more of a surface thing and the other penetrates deeper, and one you can kind of ward off a sunscreen and the other it goes through like a bullet through paper. What's that all about?
Correct. There are different sunscreens that block more UVA or UVB, block both. That's very important to go over with your physician. This gets into the whole issue of tanning beds and how some provide certain doses or higher doses of more damaging UV rays than others. Certainly dermatologists would spend quite a bit of their day talking about the differences between the two.
Yeah, Dr. Mark.
Yeah, UVB is the wavelength that causes sunburn and skin cancers. And it was thought for a long period of time that UVA was safer because it didn't cause sunburns, but we're now finding out that's not true. What happens is the natural mechanism, the AL factor with UVB is what tells people to avoid it, whereas UVA, there's not much of an AL factor. It penetrates deeper. It doesn't burn you like UVB does, but it still causes skin cancer. So when people go to tanning beds that are mostly UVA, they burn less than when they're going out in the sun, but they're getting high doses of ultraviolet radiation. They're still penetrating the skin. So like you're saying, the UVA actually penetrates deeper even though it doesn't burn the skin. So it actually can cause more problems down the road in addition to skin cancer such as wrinkles and very lax skin later in life.
I want to get into some of those impacts in just a moment, but we already have a call here on Perspective, Son of a Gun. Donna is on the line right now. Hi, Donna. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Yes, I have a question. I've never been to a dermatologist before, and I have a family history of cancer, and I'm thinking about making an appointment for a skin exam. What should I be looking for in my selection of a dermatologist?
Oh, great question. Dr. Mark, what you got?
I would say the number one thing you should look for is that they're board certified in dermatology. A lot of physicians in different specialties put themselves out as board certified, but you want to make sure it's in dermatology. The other thing you want to make sure is that they're board certified by the American Board of Medical Specialties. That's the kind of universal certifying board across most of the medical specialties in the United States. So ask them if they're board certified, and then ask them more specifically, are you board certified in dermatology?
Okay, and are there any subspecialties within this? I know we have plastic surgery represented here and dermatology. Are there any things beyond that? Or
There's actually three subspecialties within dermatology, they each traditionally require an extra year fellowship. The first subspecialty is dermatopathology, and they specialize in looking at skin that's been biopsied or operated on. The second subspecialty in dermatology is pediatric dermatology. Board-certified pediatric dermatologist does 3 years of dermatology, gets board-certified in dermatology, then does additional year in pediatric dermatology. However, most dermatologists are specialized to see kids as well by just doing their residency and being board-certified. Third is Mohs surgery. You get trained in Mohs surgery during your dermatology residency and can technically do it. However, that extra year of fellowship for Mohs surgery provides the training to not only operate but also to look at the slide you're operating on. And so a fellowship-trained Mohs surgeon is typically the highest-trained surgeon that can operate on skin cancers, especially of the head, neck, and face area for clearing the tumor within the dermatology realm.
Okay. Dr. Jessica Hune, I'm to that point now. I'm starting to get things, you know, they call liver spots and all that. And every time something pops up, I think, oh, God, is this it? You know, how can someone tell if a particular little bump or scrape or whatever on the skin might possibly be something nastier?
Sure. Well, when I see my patients, I try to give them some guidelines. And of course, that does not substitute for actually coming in and seeing somebody, because I don't expect my patients to diagnose their own skin cancer, certainly. But warning signs, there are three main kinds of skin cancer that I talk to my patients about: basal cells, squamous cells, and melanomas. And basal cells and squamous cells often look like a pimple or a bug bite that just doesn't heal. It doesn't go away. Often they bleed easily or they crust, but sometimes they don't. And so I will have a patient who will say, you know, I thought I had a bug bite, but it's been here for 6 months. that's certainly a reason to come in, although I hope that you don't wait a full 6 months, maybe 6 weeks, something like that. And then for melanomas, they can also look pink, and those are the amelanotic kind. They're more rare. But for most people, it looks like a new mole or a mole that's changing, something with different colors. So I tell them to look for black, gray, strange colors. Red, white, and blue is easy to remember. You see something that looks like those colors in a mole, you want to come in for sure. Things that are growing rapidly, that have an odd shape. If it looks like a triangle, it looks like a clover leaf, it just has an odd look to it, grows a tail on it. And I tell people that if you look at your skin and you see one thing that stands out, it's the ugly duckling sign. You're going to have moles and you're going to have freckles, especially if you live in Florida and you're fair-skinned, you're going to have some freckles. But the one that stands out is the one that you should come in for sure right away and have checked out. And that doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to be skin cancer, but it certainly deserves another look by a board-certified dermatologist.
It sort of sounds like trust your instincts on this one, huh?
Correct.
Yeah, if it looks weird, then it may not be a good thing. One thing I really want us to get into here on the other side of the break, which is going to be coming up here in just under about a minute and a half, is the situation that got just so much media attention. The gal in New Jersey, we've all seen that, the photographs of her who seemed to have taken tanning to a whole new level. And possibly got her 6-year-old daughter involved, too, by taking her into a tanning salon. Whether or not that meant the booth still has to be determined, I think, by the courts. But what that whole ramification is, and also what kind of controls do we have here in Florida? Recently, I know the Florida legislature was dealing with some kind of possible ramping up of the regulatory controls regarding tanning booths and tanning salons, which for a while were kind of popping up on every corner, it seemed. And then we have so much free sun, I keep wondering, why in the world would we want to pay for that stuff? You know, after all, Florida is a sunshine state, and we are trying to protect that precious skin of ours from an overdose of ultraviolet A, B, and other nasties here on Perspectives. Your input is welcome, too, 414-1234, 800-926-8809, perspectives@wfsu.org. We'll be right back. Perspectives, talking about skin and the threats to it, particularly when it comes to that glowing orb in the sky or the glowing tubes in the salon, which may be even worse. Let's check in with Ann. She's giving us a call here on Perspectives. Hi, Ann.
Hello. I just wanted to recommend a new cream that's out. I've suffered with basal cell cancer most of my life, and I'm 75 now. And the name of it is Aldera, and you get it from your dermatologist. And and it works wonderfully, but only on basal cell. And it's a great alternative to surgery. I have a few scars from surgery. Cream has only been out about 8 years or so. And I just wanted to let people know about that and maybe save some surgery.
Well, thanks, and appreciate that. Any feedback on that particular product, guys?
Aldera is a great medicine in the right cases. For certain small and superficial skin cancers, it can be used when surgery is not an option. Unfortunately, the cure rate is going to be a little bit lower, so it's not something you'd want to use on a high-risk tumor or in a high-risk area. In that case, you'd want to do surgery. But for certain small and superficial basal cells, it can have up to an 80% cure rate.
Wow. That's
so it certainly is a good option in certain cases.
But basal cell, as Ann said.
Correct. Basal cell, superficial, and in a non-high-risk location, yes.
So, Dr. Paredes, that's not going to put you out of a job, huh?
No, absolutely. We got plenty to work on anyway. But I think it's important to add that a lot of patients don't come in because they're scared of what's going to happen to them. So I see patients who have a cancer on their nostril, and they thought, oh, well, certainly the surgery is going to be deforming, and I'm just not going to go in because I don't want to face the fact they're going to take a piece of my nostril away. Well, just like the caller just said, sometimes we can do non-surgical things. Radiation is one form of therapy. Aldera, it's sometimes just a deep shave biopsy will get rid of it. So for a lot of patients who are scared to come in because of the fear of what's going to happen to them, nothing's going to happen at their first visit. They just need to come in and learn how to treat this cancer. And there are different methods of treatment, just like the caller said. But it's your doctor who's going to determine which is the right level of care, how aggressive do we treat it, how simply do we do it with a cream. And we get this question all the time.
Okay. Dr. Yoon, you said about the three types, basal squamous and the melanoma. Is mm-hmm. the melanoma, I mean, that's the really ugly, mean, nasty, horrible, the worst of the worst thing?
Well, certainly melanomas have a higher death rate. If you don't catch them early, they can metastasize at a much higher rate than basal cells and squamous cells. Basal cells tend to grow slowly. They certainly can metastasize, but it takes many, many years. It has to be a very big tumor in certain high-risk locations, whereas melanoma, once it invades even just a little bit into the skin, there is that risk that it can metastasize. And so you want to catch those skin cancers early, especially.
Okay. Well, we hear about the other types of cancer. In fact, during the break, we were just kind of chatting off mic about this, that the incidence of everything from lung to brain to liver cancer seems to be on the decline, and yet skin cancer is still around. Is it actually increasing? Is it getting worse?
I've read reports that melanoma is the concerning one, and it's particularly for the younger women. And we think it's an association with tanning beds, but we are seeing high rates of death in young women from melanoma, which is strange today. With so much information, it's so easily avoided by simply not going or reducing your amount of sun exposure. You know, in the old days, we would lay out with carrot oil and all sorts of different concoctions we put on our skin to purposely get red. Today, we know that 3 red burns before the age of 15 significantly increases your risk of a skin cancer later. So we know so much today, and yet people seem to ignore this information and still subject themselves to the trauma of the sun or tanning beds inducing. And we're seeing this years later. Unfortunately for younger women, we're seeing a lot more melanomas at a young age than we used to see.
And Dr. Perretti is exactly right. Last 30 years, overall melanoma incidence has been rising, and like you said, particularly in young women. In fact, the most common cancer from the age of 25 to 29 is now melanoma. And the second most common cancer in the ages 15 to 29, second to childhood leukemias, is melanoma. And so it's becoming a cancer of the young, again, mainly through sun exposure, which we believe is probably through artificial means of getting that ultraviolet radiation.
Okay, we talk about the tanning beds. And Dr. Glaser, we got to talk to you here in a second on what you have been doing as far as some interface with the Florida legislature and that. But Dr. Yoon, when you saw that picture of the lady in New Jersey, what was your initial reaction? Horror, shock, what?
Well, unfortunately, it's common. Tanning bed use is extremely common, and certainly that's an extreme case. But we see a lot of patients who have abused tanning beds in our practice, and I'm sure that a lot of dermatologists would agree that tanning bed use is way too common. And you do see parents who have their teenagers using tanning beds before prom and, you know, getting a little tan before they go to the beach. And so I would say, yes, it's shocking. But on the other hand, it's probably not shocking enough because we do see it way more often than we should.
And there's no controls on this. I mean, you go into a tanning salon and no one asks you, gee, have you been in a salon earlier this week or earlier this month? It's just like, you know, you're going into a convenience store to get a soft drink. No one cards you or asks you if you've indulged before, right? You just keep going.
It's hard to follow this because nobody's doing a study on the number of times you're going and how that's, as far as I know, how that's affecting you 20 years later. But you are exposing yourself to a level of UVA radiation that we don't think is healthy for you.
Okay,
and by the way, you just self-tan. Just use a spray. If prom's coming up, and I see the same story come through my office – a week before prom, get a spray tan.
But I don't want to be orange.
Get a good spray tan. They are out there.
There are several studies that have looked at melanoma patients and their use of tanning beds. And one of the larger studies suggested that those that had ever used a tanning bed had a 75% increase in the rates of melanoma. And there were some different studies that looked at the doses and frequency of tanning beds. And some people that used it regularly had up to a 400% increase in those studies in the rates of melanoma. So there's more and more information coming out, up to the point where last year the World Health Organization listed tanning beds as a carcinogen in the same category as tobacco, mustard gas, and nuclear waste.
Oh, well, we know that there are all kinds of regulatory strictures on those things you just mentioned, but I understand you went before the Florida legislature and rang some alarm bells and said, hey, guys, we got a problem with the tanning salons, too. What kind of reaction? Did they go into emergency alarm mode and say, yes, we must deal with this immediately, or what?
Well, the legislation has been brought forward the last couple of years by Senator Sobel from South Florida. She's been a champion for trying to get more oversight of tanning beds. The current law is that you can use a tanning bed between the ages of 14 and 17 as long as you have a parent's signature. However, the parent does not have to sign that in person. So it does not behoove the industry to call and check and see if that signature is actually the parent. So I'm sure someone could theoretically just show up and sign and tan. And so the issue is regulation and parents' rights to what their children can do versus the potential harms of tanning beds. And I really think the issue is going to be the next cigarettes. Years ago, oh, cigarettes are fine. They don't do anything. And now we know better. 20 years from now, we're going to feel that way about tanning beds. And so the legislation is gaining momentum. California, I think, was the first state to pass a law saying that children under 18 could not use tanning beds. And that's what we're trying to push in Florida, because even though children under 14 can't tan, I think it's too much to have, even with parental signatures, children from 14 to 17 still be able to use a known cancer-causing agent. So it comes up every year, and I think with it being in the media and being in the news more, I think it is going to gain more traction. And hopefully in the next coming years, the legislature will look at this seriously and act on it as not an issue with too much regulation, but really a public safety issue, a public health issue.
Now, speaking of the media, though, what kind of impact do media representations like – I'm thinking Jersey Shore. You know, those guys are usually too hungover to go and hang out on the beach, so they got to go to the tanning salon, right, you know, before they go back and hit the club that night. Why the salon when the sun is free? I mean, it is not inexpensive to go to a tanning salon. Dr. Yoon, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think part of the thing is people who go into tanning beds do go in nude. So you certainly can get an all-over tan in a tanning bed that you probably aren't getting when you're going out to the park or the beach in most cases. And I think the other thing that we didn't mention is that tanning and tanning beds and tanning outside to some degree is actually addictive. The tanning beds, when you go in, under the UV, you actually have an opiate-like effect in the brain, and people actually become kind of dependent on this. And so it's easy to schedule and get your dose of tanning in, you know, in a tanning bed quickly. You walk in, you take your clothes off, you sit in. It's actually probably a little bit more convenient. You know it's not going to be raining in there. You know that you're going to get your dose. And so I think that's the other factor that that people don't really think about or talk about, but it really is addictive. And you have to realize that, you know, when you talk to people, it's not completely rational what they're doing, because we talk a lot about skin cancers and risks, and there's no question. And, you know, and the same is true of cigarettes. I mean, why do people still smoke? Why do people still use tanning beds when they know it's bad for them? I think there's another factor there that we have to think about and remember.
Brain chemistry, Dr. Alfredo, any studies been done on that, that maybe, you know, serotonin levels in the brain or something kick up when
there are definitely associations of personality types, and personality at the base is a neurotransmitter issue. But absolutely, there are going to be some personality types that are more likely to be, quote, addicted to something than something else. We can give pain medicine to 100 people and only a certain percentage are going to have an addiction problem. Same thing with, like Jessica's saying, with tanning beds, with cigarettes. It's the same issue.
Yeah, we had someone in here, it was about 6 months ago, I guess, some addiction specialists from Tallahassee Memorial, who postulated there is really only one form of addiction, and that is you can have a multiplicity of things that trigger the same brain chemistry.
It's a crave receptor in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
There's even medications out there for smokers, Chantix, for instance, that look at – try to inhibit the crave receptor. It doesn't block the nicotine receptor. It's blocking the crave receptor. There are some studies actually looking at that same medication for other addictions, alcoholism, and other problems, but it does boil down to one crave receptor the brain has.
That would seem to make sense. I wanted to throw in something here from our pal Rick Oppenheim, who was sending out a release here about Gulf Coast dermatology. They're having at least a screening that is going to be coming up this Saturday from 9 until noon. And let's see where the location of that is. Well, you can also go to gulfcoastderm.com to find out some more information on that. And it is on Market Street, second floor of the Market Street Plaza, next to Atlanta Bread. And that's going on this Saturday from 9 until noon, just to find out if you are at least in a predisposition or you have some danger signals that might be indicating that further investigation needs to be done on that. Okay, cure. We talked about the risks and all that. The fact that there is something called Aldira, which works for or at least helps out in basal cell skin cancers. But if it comes to surgery, Dr. Alfredo, since that's your specialty there, doesn't necessarily have to be deforming. It can be essentially invisible, or how
we get that question quite a bit. And so the word invisible doesn't really exist for surgery. Anytime anybody makes an incision with a scalpel, there's going to be a scar. The real question is, what kind of scar is it? Is it a tolerable scar? Is it a hidden scar? Is it a hardly seen scar? But the notion that a plastic surgeon can magically wave a sharp instrument and make nothing happen is really not possible. The reality, though, is that there are many techniques that we've learned, that dermatologists have learned, of how to hide a scar in a certain area. Really, a lot of it comes down to where it is. If it's on your eyelid, tip of your nose, nostrils, central part of your cheek, that's a different sort of talk I'm going to have with someone who has it hidden behind their ear, in their scalp, lower back. It's just a different conversation. And there are different ways we can do things. If a patient comes to me with skin cancer, center of their cheek, I'm going to have 10 different ways we can talk about removing it and then closing the defect. You then start getting into Mohs surgery, and where we work, you talk about high-end surgery, we're talking about working in combination now with two doctors. You have a dermatologist who's subspecialty trained to remove the cancer, immediately look at it under the microscope and get immediate clearance of the tumor. Their cure rate is on a conservative end 95%, and for some people 99%. Then when you show up at the plastic surgeon's office, we're just dealing with a little circular hole in the center of your cheek, and then we're charged with reconstructing that defect. And that tends to be how we get very involved in Tallahassee. Plastic surgeons do cut out skin cancers from time to time, but we generally are much more involved with the Mohs surgeons closing essentially the little hole that they left behind. And we've been trained at different techniques on how to do that, but the scar you're going to get, that talk is much easier given when we see where it is, what size it is, how much surgery are they willing to go through. Some things we can do in one stage. Some things require a few stages. But I can tell you, in the vast majority of the time, it can be done under local anesthesia, right in our office. You come over with a Band-Aid, take the Band-Aid off, numb it up, and we close it. It rarely needs to go to the operating room, which is nice for most people. So even an elderly person on multiple medications with heart and breathing problems can still have their skin cancer taken care of.
You mentioned Mohs, M-O-H-S. What's that
Correct.
Stand for?
That's actually named after the surgeon that invented the technique. And certainly a dermatologist is going to tell you a lot more about that. But it's a method by which they can actually map out essentially the disc of tissue they cut out. And they'll say at a 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, all the way around a clock. And then when they – now they've been trained how to do pathology, which is looking at this tissue on a slide. They can actually look at that and say, hey, you know what? I still got a few cells left between 1 and 2 o'clock. Well, they go back to the patient, still in their office, still numb, and go and take a little extra section out. Then they can go back to the microscope and actually say, you know, I got the whole thing. So the beauty is, when it comes to a plastic surgeon, is when I reconstruct that defect, I'm not worried that I'm going to be picking up skin that might still have cancer in it, putting it right back where it started. And so Mohs reconstruction has the highest cure rate that we know of. It's a very high-end way of treating skin cancers. It tends to be more utilized on areas where skin is prime, nose, lips, eyelids, ears, the face, places where people say, you know what, the scar does bother me. If it's on the center of your forearm, I'll tell you, a lot of people don't end up having Mohs. They can, but they don't necessarily have to, just because you can get out a little bit extra skin and likely clear the tumor. On your eyelid, I don't want someone just taking a centimeter and a half of extra skin out when I don't necessarily need to. And that's where a Mohs surgeon comes in so effectively.
Oh, it's almost like a real-time biopsy while you're doing
the
thing.
It is. The surgeon and the pathologist are the same person. And so I tell people in simple terms, you get the highest cure with the smallest hole. And we tell them basically, like Dr. Prater was saying, it's tissue sparing. So you don't need to take out all this extra tissue when you do Mohs surgery. You only take out where the tumor is and leave as much healthy, normal tissue as you can. So that's the benefit of doing the surgery and the pathology all at once. And then when we send them over for either closures ourselves or closures by our plastic surgeons, they have the best chance of having the smallest scar because the least amount of tissue has been taken out. And exactly like he's saying, Mohs surgery does not need to be done everywhere, only for high-risk tumors or where a tissue is at a premium. So I agree, like something on the back or the arm doesn't necessarily need it, but places where you want to spare tissue, that's where you do it.
Boy, this is not granddaddy surgery, is it?
No.
Really? Because any kind of skin surgery, I remember even just a generation ago, this was very, very serious stuff. And you were very often left with a nasty deformation or just a very ugly situation afterwards. So it's come a long way in a short period of time. But still the best thing is not to have to undergo this
Correct.
Thing in the first place.
Correct.
We're talking about skin cancer since May is National Skin Cancer Awareness Month. I bet you didn't know that, but that's why we're on this subject here on Perspectives Today. 414-1234, the number to call in Tallahassee, long distance 800-926-8809, and perspectives@wfsu.org. We'll be right back. Feeling we were going to get a flood of calls on this one here. Let's go to line one as we delve more into the idea of protecting your skin from nasty stuff here on Perspectives. Hi, Erica. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question about people who don't have insurance and if there's any local resources available for them to see a dermatologist.
Okay. Folks, any alternative? Dr.
I'd love to help answer that. So the Capital Medical Society for years has sponsored a WeCare network. And the WeCare Network is essentially an alliance of physicians who are willing to treat people who have no insurance and nothing gets charged to the patient. This would include even hospitalizations or outpatient surgery centers, even anesthesia where it's necessary, which typically for something like skin cancer is not needed. But Tallahassee is unique in a well-concerted effort by physicians to help treat people who don't have insurance. So all of us on the WeCare Network routinely see people without insurance. Happy to do so. And it involves calling the Capital Medical Society office and asking to be referred into the WeCare network. And it gets you plugged in to find a physician who's willing to do it. These are our board certified physicians who treat everyone in society. And you can get excellent care through the WeCare network. It includes really almost every physician in Tallahassee.
Okay. Are there any income restrictions on this or is it pretty wide open?
There is a procedure, a application process for someone who truly needs to have it be through a WeCare network. There are other options for patients who just, let's say, want to pay cash just like a dentist's office does. And I think that just being up front with the billing office and the doctor up front, you'd be surprised how many physicians are willing to help take care of you through some arrangement that you can make outside of insurance.
Gosh, I hope that helps, Erica. Let's keep the calls going. John is here in Tallahassee. Hi, John.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. I just recently picked up your program, so I didn't have the benefit of who your guests were and what whether they were physicians or physicians and association medical association folks. But the issue of alternative to surgery, I don't know if y'all have discussed this, but obviously, I would think that depending on the severity of your cells, dwell into that a little bit. I'm thinking right off the top of my head that you've seen the folks that have used the cream and and the effect on that. And then you also have, I think there's a laser method. So I'm thinking there certainly is a more alternative other than surgery for those that can benefit from both of the alternatives. Go into that a little bit, if you would, please, and I'll listen to your comments off the air.
Okay, John, and thanks again for a reminder for those folks who just joined the program. We have Dr. Alfredo Paredes, who is board-certified plastic surgeon. We have Dr. Mark Inglés, board-certified dermatologist, and another board-certified dermatologist, Dr. Jessica Yoon, with us here on Perspectives. And about the alternatives to surgery, Dr. Inglés, what you think?
Actually, we have in our practice probably 8 or 9 different ways to treat skin cancer based on the size, location, severity. We have cryosurgery, which uses temperature to kill tumor cells. You can do curettage, where the tumor cells are scraped off the surface of the skin and then the base either lightly treated with electricity or, again, with some more cryosurgery. We have topical medicines. Aldera is one of them. Effudex can be used in some cases. There's intralesional interferon, which can be used for some basal cells, and that is 9 injections over 3 weeks. After that, there's standard surgery, excisions, Mohs surgery, and there's also radiation therapy, which can be done in the dermatology's office for a certain select cancer. So there, the caller is exactly right. There's a lot of different ways to treat skin cancer. So you need to make sure you talk to your doctor about the options because, again, depending on where it is, what it is, we have got many, many different ways that are appropriate for many different skin cancers.
Yeah, he mentioned laser therapy,
yes,
too.
Yes. Yeah, carbon dioxide laser is a good way for some things that could theoretically be curetted but are on very, very thin skin. Using the carbon dioxide laser to gently remove that top layer of skin is a very nice way to treat certain skin cancers below the elbows or below the knees.
Okay, but not the real deep stuff. That probably doesn't work too well.
Yeah, exactly. The non-surgical interventions can only go so far, and that's why you need to have the surgical interventions available.
414-1234, 800-926-8809. Judy here in Tallahassee. Hi, Judy.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, for years and years I was treated for precancer on my left cheek, having spent a lot of years in Central Florida in the sun, and eventually one part was diagnosed with a squamous cell and was removed surgically and closed by a plastic surgeon. I just have two questions. How likely is it that cancer will reoccur in this particular area? And because of the treatments and the surgery and all, this part of my face is discolored. What is the best way to fade that out? And is it likely that there are still cancer cells in some part of that area that will recur?
Wow, who wants to jump on that one?
Happy to help with that one. There's a few questions in there. The first was your recurrence risk, and so it does turn out that Mohs surgery offers statistically the highest cure rate. Otherwise, the surgeon's often removing it, utilizing something called frozen section control. I'm not sure if you had that, but using frozen sections, a pathologist elsewhere in a different building, that's how that works, calls back and says you're clear, you close it up. Every once in a while, that quick test can be wrong. That's why Mohs surgery can be better in that sense, okay? But nonetheless, if you've been free of cancer for a while, the importance is to make sure that you see your dermatologist at least once a year. Once you have a skin cancer, most of my dermatology colleagues are seeing people twice, three, four times, every quarter, four times a year. And so despite the fact you've had it removed and closed, that area needs to have constant surveillance. So we hope you're cured, but you do need to keep thinking about it. You can't just walk away from that cancer and go to the rest of your body. If you see a scaly, itchy, red lesion in the scar, that needs to be biopsied again. The next comes to the scar itself. How it's closed, what type of closure you had impacts the advice I'd give you. But if it was just closed primarily with stitches, you'll have a purple scar, and it depends how long ago it was. Scars will look bad for the first 2 months. Over the next several months, they'll get better. But are you getting it in the sun? Are you putting sunscreen on it? Are you wearing a big wide-brim hat? If you get a lot of sun on a scar in its first year, it's going to be purple, red, quite visible. And often the color is what draws attention to it. A very simple way of treating that is just a silicone strip. So today you can go to Walgreens, CVS, and buy a Walgreens brand silicone strip therapy. It'll be a large rectangular Band-Aid looking thing that for something like that, you can just cut a little thin rectangle, stick it on your skin once a day, every day for at least 3 months. You have to be religious about it for it to work. And you will see a lot of resolution of the skin discoloration. Along with that, careful adherence to sunscreen and hats when you're outside. After about a year, it's going to tan about the same as the rest of your skin, but silicone is quite effective. On top of that, there's laser treatments, there's steroid injections, steroid tapes, there's all sorts of things you can do for it. A lot of it has to do with how long it's been there, but silicone strips have been shown to help 2 months later, 2 years later.
Is there, Dr. Yoon, a predisposition for a recurrence of skin cancer on a particular area? You had it there once. There's a higher chance you'll get it there again?
Well, certainly any place that you've had a skin cancer has probably seen a lot of sun. And so you probably have a higher risk there just by virtue of the fact that you've had one before and you've had a lot of UV there. And that's in addition to the site itself, where certainly if you've had Mohs surgery, you have a very high cure rate. And a lot of the other methods have a good cure rate too, but there's always the possibility that a cell was left behind. It can come back. But I do worry about the area in general where you've had a skin cancer, because that suggests that you've had a significant amount of UV damage there. So that area should be watched as well. And other areas. So if you've had a skin cancer on the face, the entire face is at increased risk for skin cancer, as well as the rest of the UV exposed body. So the forearms, the hands. If you've been a farmer and you've been out without your shirt on, your chest and back, your neck. So people who get skin cancers do have a higher risk of getting more skin cancers. There's no question.
So don't ignore those little postcards or email reminders to come back in and do the follow-up if you've been through this. Most folks, I think, this falls under the urban legend kind of thing, but a cloudy day, I don't need sunscreen or anything else. That's no good, right? I mean, you still got the sun and the UV still coming through, right?
Those are the worst days because people tend to put their guard down.
Ah, okay. And also, you had mentioned, Doctor, earlier in the program that it's not just that we have more sunny days in Florida. The actual geographical position of the state makes us a little bit more dangerous to be than, let's say, Massachusetts.
Absolutely. I mean, I've not looked at the numbers of how much Mohs surgery is happening in Montana, but I would presume that Florida would get much more of it. We have our skin exposed. We have short shorts, small shirts, tank tops. And we're just out there all year long, which is why we moved to Florida, most of us. But ironically, we have to be more careful about our sun exposure, despite the fact it's the reason it brought us here to begin with.
Yeah, and more direct sun exposure because it doesn't go through as many layers of the atmosphere before it hits us.
Latitude and altitude.
Well, we have about 8 minutes remaining in the program. By the way, if you still want to get in a quick call or comment, you can do that at 414-1234, 800-926-8809. Is it worse at the beach? More sun exposure at the beach, because it's not only coming down, it can also come like sideways or even from under us because of the reflective thing or does sand absorb UV radiation? Anybody know?
I think there is a little bit a higher risk because of the reflection off the water. I think the other thing too is if you're in the water, you're obviously not getting any sun protection. And people tend to dip in the water. They come out. They're not wearing sunscreen. They're not wearing sun protective clothing. So I do see a lot of people who go on beach trips or go on boat trips and they come back extremely sunburned, especially in their backs. And so I don't know if that's virtue of the UV at the beach or if that's virtue of what you're doing at the beach or both. But you definitely have to be careful there. And that's when I really like for people to wear the sun shirts. And you can actually buy a detergent called SunGuard. And I think there's another one too, where you can wash your white T-shirts that usually have an SPF of 4. You can wash them with SunGuard. It lasts for 20 washes and you'll have an SPF of 30. Now, it's actually a UPF when it's on your clothing, which is an ultraviolet protective factor. So I think those things are really important to remember. You know, you're out there in your little swimsuit. You're going to get sunburned if you're not careful.
Well, even if you are careful and you do all of the stuff that you've been recommending here, folks, and you do come down with a burn, What do you do? What's the most effective topical treatment for it? And is it available over the counter? Or what do you suggest for folks who do get a burn? Not a horrible, hideous burn, but just one that, ouch.
Just a red sunburn. Well, so people understand that's the when you define burns, that red burning your skin, a sunburn is a first degree burn. When that skin starts to blister, it's a second degree burn, just like you burned yourself at home with a grease fire. So there's no difference in terms of the damage caused to the skin. So really the idea is to prevent that red burn. But I teach my kids this all the time. When you've turned red, you have now damaged your skin. Most specifically, the sun has caused an oxidative damage of your DNA. When your body goes to repair that damaged DNA, it sometimes makes an error. And that error creates a cell that can turn into a cancer cell. So the issue is to avoid the redness. Once you're red, you're cooked. You've gone past the point you should have. You've now damaged your skin. You have now set yourself up for a future skin cancer. Once you've got the red burn, really simple treatments like Aquaphor, petroleum dressings. I'm fine with the over-the-counter Publix, aloe vera gels. The reality is it's time that's going to make the red skin better. Once you're blistered, that's pretty bad. It would be a pretty bad sunburn to require a visit to a doctor that actually has to prescribe a cream. But simple things like even Aquaphor ointment are just fine. But it's mostly time that your skin is just going to have to repair itself. You've gone too far.
Yeah, and do you guys see people who just come in for, just a bad blistered sunburn?
Occasionally in the summer times, yeah. People come in for that.
Wow. And you have to prescribe then something a little bit more with more oomph in it than what you would get over the counter?
Usually, again, I do the same thing as Dr. Paredes, Aquaphor or some sort of occlusive dressing, even Vaseline, because the main treatment is symptomatic relief. And if there's open areas, we use Aquaphor or Vaseline to try to minimize any scarring from it. But most people that come in burned say, well, I was applying sunscreen all day and I still got burned. And I think what people don't know when it comes to sunscreen and sunburns is, there's that old myth that, oh, well, SPF 30 blocks this much, so SPF 70 is not that different. So the truth is, when used correctly, there's not a difference. When used incorrectly, there's a huge difference. And so when you put on SPF 30 in the wrong amounts, which everyone does because no one puts it on super goopy, you don't get half the sun protection by putting on half the amount. You get a quarter. So if you put on 30 incorrectly, you get 7. You put 100 on incorrectly, you're still probably going to get 25 or 30. So that's the rationale for the higher SPF sunscreens to prevent sunburn is that 99% of people don't put enough on. And if you're going to try to squeeze by with a thin amount of sunscreen, you need that high SPF.
Well, let's see if we can get in one more call here in Perspectives. How about Candace on line one? Hi, Candace. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. I have heard that there are oral supplements such as daily vitamins that you can take, and I can't remember exactly which vitamin, to both protect against sunburn and also if you happen to get sunburn to help it heal faster. Is that true or is that a myth?
A miracle cure, or at least a miracle prevention. Anybody hear about an anti-sunburn pill?
Go ahead. I'll add. But
I think she's talking about beta-carotene, but – that is a supplement found in carrots. If you take it in very, very high amounts, you get what kind of looks like a tan, but it's really just an orangey coloring of your skin called carotenemia from the beta carotene. Some studies have shown that it can give you like a 1 to 2, maybe 3 increase in SPF, but not very much over baseline. So I would not count on that as far as sun protection.
And you may have read a little bit about vitamin C as well. So dermatologists, plastrons now utilize a lot of high vitamin C dosed serums and creams that we give in our skincare clinics that actually have been shown to help mitigate the effects of sun on your skin. Vitamin C is a powerful antioxidant. Sun is causing oxidative damage to your skin. And so vitamin C, in a sense, is cleaning up those oxygen radicals, sucking up that negativity, and preventing the damage incurred by this poisonous sun exposure. The problem is orally, if you try to take enough vitamin C orally to get to the level that, let's say, a 20% vitamin C serum would get on your skin, you'd be eating oranges all day long. You'd never make it out to the beach. So you just can't get it orally like you can topically. I'm not sure, though, that I'd recommend utilizing just, let's say, 20% topical vitamin C serum in lieu of sunscreen. It would actually be a combination of the two. And so a lot of our patients come in for skincare, I get them to use both.
That is the height of irony, because the rationale that our parents used to use to send us out into the broiling hot sun was, you need your vitamin D, and sunshine creates vitamin D, so sure. Get out there.
So, I just want to add one thing to that. I do think it's important to eat healthy. I think that if you have a high antioxidant diet, that does help you. But one thing I wanted to add as we were talking about sunscreens is that sunscreen is just a screen, and it does not replace staying out of that midday sun. It does not. You're not going to be able to go out in the midday sun with sunscreen on and be fully protected. You're still going to get sunburn, and you can eat antioxidants and all of those good things and still get burned. So
no,
be careful.
Just be careful. Be careful. If we learn nothing else from the show. Dr. Jessica Hune, thanks so much for coming in. Dr. Mark Inglese and Dr. Alfredo Paredes. Great to have you on Perspectives
Thank you.
Today.
Thank you.
I'm going to go out and stay out of the sun. Hey, Perspectives is produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee. Technical assistance by Taylor Cox. And we had Nicole Knight on the phones and all today. I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week. More expert opinion and your phone calls here on Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.